Just how genre-defying and literally out of this world is Michel Faber's new novel? Marcel Theroux will be here to talk about his cover review this week of The Book of Strange New Things.
I think speculative is what science fiction calls itself when it's at a dinner party. It deals with alternate possible realities and futures.
How did Abraham Lincoln deal with bad press? Harold Holzer will join us to talk about his new book, Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion.
So he was a wire puller who knew the press well. He knew journalists. And by the way, secured their loyalty once he was elected.
We'll have the latest update from the publishing world. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Marcel Theroux joins me now. He has reviewed on our cover this week the new book by Michel Faber, The Book of Strange New Things. Hi, Marcel.
Hi, Pamela.
Actually, before we talk about the book, tell us about Michel Faber.
Michel Faber. Well, I guess Michel Faber is best known for his second novel, The Crimson Petal and the White, which was a kind of sprawling Victorian melodrama that was an acclaimed TV series here in the UK. And this book is actually nothing like that. It resembles more closely his first novel, which was called Under the Skin. And that actually was recently turned into a movie, which I haven't seen. But Under the Skin is a speculative novel. I don't want to give the plot away because it is such an extraordinary book. And part of the pleasure is figuring out what's going on.
For our listeners who don't exactly know what that means, what is speculative? When you say speculative fiction, what do you mean?
That's a very good question, Pamela. I think speculative is what science fiction calls itself when it's at a dinner party. It's science fiction. It deals with alternate possible realities and futures.
It's science fiction dressed up for a literary engagement.
I think so.
All right. And there's a bit of an interesting backstory with this particular book in that it's been 10 years since his previous book.
It's been 10 years since his last novel. I think in the intervening time, he's published a lot of short stories. He's also known as a short story writer. But it's taken him a while to write another book. And this is a big one. It's about a man who is tasked with the job of going to another planet as a Christian missionary. His name is Peter. And in the opening chapters of the book, he bids farewell to his wife, Beatrice, and he heads off for a light years long space voyage to a planet called Oasis, where he has been employed to minister to the indigenous population.
When does this take place?
Obviously, the technology of the novel is such that it can't exactly be the present. But the world that Peter leaves behind is very recognizably the 21st century Earth. It's plagued by the same kind of problems, although all ratcheted up a notch. So climate change is an issue. There's a very unstable geopolitical situation. But it's not a million miles away from the world that we unfortunately read about in the pages of the newspaper. But that having been said, it's clear that I suppose this is the speculative dimension. This is the what if of the novel.
Right.
Another planet has been discovered and a tentative approach has been made to colonizing it.
Now, it's also in many ways a love story, right? You mentioned that he leaves
That's
behind
right.
his wife, B.
Yes, he's leaving his wife, Beatrice, behind and their cat. The distances are kind of unimaginably vast between them. So all normal means of communication are severed. They're able to send kind of emails to each other by a not quite specified technology. So while he's on the planet Oasis, it's not named Oasis by its inhabitants, by the way. It was named Oasis after a competition run by the corporation, won by a little girl in the Midwest who decided to christen it Oasis. And while he's in Oasis, he receives updates about life on Earth, and he hears about the trials and tribulations that his wife's going through.
Now, I know that it's a tricky business to read too much autobiography into a novel, but the publisher has been very upfront about the fact that one of the reasons, or the main reason, for the 10-year period between Faber's last novel and this one was because Faber's wife, Eva, was diagnosed with a highly aggressive cancer, and she ultimately died just recently, but he had took off that time in order to take care of her. And then here you have this love story that's very much about being separated.
Well, that's absolutely right. And while there's no there's none of that explicitly in the book, it's shot through with the sense of separation, the sense of foreboding, and with a kind of anxiety about death. I mean, that's one of the major preoccupations of the novel. I was aware of that backstory when I was reading it. I mean, it's a heart-wrenching novel anyway, but knowing that, you understand that he's kind of grappling dramatically with some of these. Artistically, I should say, he's grappling artistically with the issues brought up by his wife's illness.
It's also a book about religion, about faith.
It's hugely about religion. Actually, while I was reading it, I was reminded that in the last UK census in 2011, about 150,000 people answered the question on religion by saying that they belonged to the Jedi faith. And I think in the previous census, there were almost 300,000 Jedi in the UK. So the force is diminishing somewhat. But I think one of the things that the novel is about the strange origins of religion, that humanity finds solace in all kinds of extraordinary stories, whether it's the Bible, the Quran, or indeed the films of George Lucas. And one of the things that he's doing in the book, that Michel Faber's doing in the book, is he's sort of looking at the origin myth of a new religion, of a fresh religion on another planet. So what is kind of the omega of Peter's journey to this planet, Oasis, is the alpha for another planet, for a new and alien congregation way out in space. And this is all done, I must say, very, very subtly. I don't think that Michel Faber has a pretentious bone in his body. But there's an unmistakable profundity, I think, in his writing.
When you, I'm glad you brought that up, because it can seem like an intimidating novel on the surface of it, this speculative fiction.
That's right. And even describing it to you, Pamela, I feel aware that lots of readers who would traditionally choose naturalistic novels are going to be put off by the idea that there's spaceships and aliens and weird-looking people, and I don't know how to overcome that prejudice. But I think if you just picked up the book and you read the first 20 pages, you'd understand this is not sci-fi as you know it. This is someone who's deeply concerned with what it means to be human, with issues of loss and estrangement and death, religion, belief, and you know, the book's just rewarding on so many levels, and one of the hopes that I have for it is that it kind of rehabilitates that genre for a new readership, for people who might pass it by. And I think that, you know, Under the Skin achieved that for me. It wasn't a genre that I was particularly crazy about, but reading that, I don't know, it must have been 10 or 15 years ago, I was bowled over by it. It seemed a very, very brave thing to do as well, because it's not a genre that wins you a lot of credibility on the whole with reviewers or prizes. It's kind of ghettoized, which is a shame for everyone, really.
Do you read a lot of science fiction?
I don't read a huge amount of science fiction. You know, I'm slightly intimidated by the inwardness of the genre, but there's science fiction that I like, and I'd have to say that the Strugatsky brothers and Stanislaw Lem would be high on the list. But then also, I think that, you know, we mustn't overlook the fact that there are, before science fiction was invented, there were a lot of writers working in science fiction kind of avant la lettre, that, you know, George Eliot dabbled in science fiction. There's, you know, the example of Mary Shelley. Frankenstein is an early example of science fiction. The George Eliot book, that novel, it's more of a short story. It's called The Lifted Veil,
right?
Which is not widely read, but it's you think of her as the naturalistic novelist of the English 19th century par excellence, but here she is dabbling in the uncanny and the strange and kind of thought transference. So I think it's good for writers to mix it up and try different things.
For the listener here who might not be aware of this novel or might not be inclined to science fiction, you obviously loved the book. It's apparent in your cover review for us. What would you say to a potential reader about this book that would sort of sell them on the idea of trying out a work of speculative fiction?
Try out a work of speculative fiction. The book, when you open it, you just open it, give it 10 pages. The book does not start with aliens and time travel and Doctor Who in a long scarf. It is not that kind of book. It's about a man going on a long journey, saying goodbye to his wife at an airport. You know, it's literally down to earth. And Faber does an excellent job of taking the reader from our known reality onto this extraordinary journey.
All right. I think that will sell many readers on the possibility. Thank you so much, Marcel.
My pleasure.
That was Marcel Theroux talking about his cover review of Michel Faber's new novel, The Book of Strange New Things.
This is Parul Segal, an editor at The Book Review. I'm joined now by our publishing reporter, Alexandra Alter. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Parul.
So, Alexandra, I hear you have a very magical, very New York kind of story about publishing.
This is why writers still move to New York, even though it's so expensive. So this week, Alfred A. Knopf announced that they had acquired this manuscript from a waitress in the West Village, and it's a novel that's set in a restaurant, but the way it came to them was really sort of a perfect little New York story. It came through Peter Gathers, who's a senior vice president and editor-at-large at Penguin Random House, and he's been in publishing for more than 30 years. He's used to people coming up to him all the time,
right,
and saying, I just finished my novel. And so he's usually not blown away by these books, but this time it was a waitress from one of his favorite West Village restaurants, Bouvet.
Mm-hmm.
And the book that he said, have your agent send it to me. That's his usual polite line.
And probably forgot, I'm sure.
Completely forgets. And then the book comes in, and within 10 pages, he said he's completely blown away. He's calling everyone in the office. Other people have already heard about it from the agent, and there's all this excitement. And this was happening in the midst of the Frankfurt Book Fair, when everyone's frantically reading manuscripts from all over the world, but this one really jumped out at them. The author's name is Stephanie Danler. She's 30 years old, and she was in her fourth waitressing job in New York, moved here in 2006, and got her MFA at the New School at Night. And so it's just one of those sort of charming little stories that, you don't hear about happening too much. And as it happens, Peter Gathers said there's another waitress at the same restaurant who's finishing a novel, and he's excited to read it too. She told him about it. He's expecting it at the end of the month.
Well, it's nice to hear that can still happen.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the book too, the restaurant connection is really fitting because it's set in this fictional restaurant, but it's really the Union Square Cafe where she used to be a waitress, and publishing industry executives eat there all the time. So it's sort of a double inside joke, but it really takes you inside this sort of glamorous and sometimes seedy world of high-end, New York restaurants.
Right, which is a popular genre in itself, right? The
restaurant
memoir, the
restaurant
novel.
Memoir and sort of the food novel. And
that's
I think there's something about those sort of
contained spaces,
exactly.
and the stress. And I hear, and I think you covered this, that apparently just the way she writes about food is supposed to be incredibly exciting and sensuous.
Yeah, they sent me just a few pages because the book isn't, unfortunately, coming out until 2016, so we'll have to wait. But yes, she has a really specific way. You can tell that this is someone who loves food, who's been around it, who works with it every day. So the other thing that's happening this week in publishing that everyone will be excited to hear is there's more content coming to Pottermore, which is J.K. Rowling's site.
Rejoice. So what can we expect?
She's been posting regularly there, and it seems like more and more. In time for Halloween, there's going to be a new story about the villain Dolores Umbridge, who apparently is one of the characters that J.K. Rowling feels the most dislike for.
Oh, she's one of the most terrifying characters.
Yeah, she's one of the most terrifying characters in the series. And in addition to the new sort of background information about her, we learn a little bit about the real person that she was apparently based on, which is exciting. But it's an interesting sort of publishing story in itself, because J.K. Rowling kept the ebook rights to the Harry Potter series, which, if you can imagine, mm-hmm. has sold more than 450 million copies mm-hmm. in print. Mm-hmm. So for her to hold on to the ebook rights is really exceptional.
Yeah, yeah.
And by posting new content on her website, she's constantly attracting new people there, reminding them that there's a new ebook for sale, there's this. And it's a way to keep the series alive and keep it going, but it's also a way for her to draw people to
a site. That's so much more canny. My explanation was that she just missed it. And she couldn't stay away. And she wanted to be in Hogwarts.
I have a more cynical view, but I'm sure it's a combination.
I hope so. Okay, thank you so much, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Harold Hoser joins us now. He is the author of Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion. Hi, Harold.
Hi, Pamela. Thanks for asking me to do this.
You have written many books about Lincoln. Perhaps you can tell us quickly how many?
Well, including co-authored and edited books, this is 47.
47. But this is a big one for you. Why was this subject so important?
Because I've spent my life not only studying and writing about Abraham Lincoln, but working with the press in my various positions as a public affairs representative, both for in politics, in government, and in the arts. So this interplay between the press and politics has been a part of my life for 40 years, and it just has always obsessed me to get it straight about how Lincoln dealt with the press in his era and how the press dealt with him and how the press dealt with each other.
There are a lot of surprises in the book, I think, things that run counter to much of the mythology that runs around Lincoln. Give us a sense of the landscape. What was the press like in Lincoln's time?
Well, it was undisguisedly and almost merrily and violently on occasion partisan. There were no disguises. There was no attempt to say that journalists or newspapers were playing it straight down the middle. They were either Democratic or Republican newspapers. They aligned themselves with the parties. They fought for party candidates and party platforms and ideals and candidates. Candidates made their headquarters and their lives in newspaper offices. Abraham Lincoln certainly did that in both Springfield and Chicago and in New York when he gave the Cooper Union address. And moreover, newspaper men often came out of the political world. Politicians often came out of the newspaper world. But in a number of absolutely astonishing instances, editors were politicians at the same time they remained editors. And that was true for the whole 15, 20 years of Lincoln's national political life.
Kind of like lobbyists and politicians today.
It's even more so. I mean, I hate to pin the most egregious or most amusing examples on the New York Times, but Henry Raymond, the founder of the New York Times, was Speaker of the New York State Assembly before he founded the paper, and an assemblyman after he founded the paper, serving concurrently in the mess of the New York State Assembly. But by the way, it was a mess in the 1850s as well, as well as some people say it is now. And in 1864, Henry Raymond, who 4 years earlier, by the way, was the keynote speaker at the first Republican National Convention.
He was a moderate Republican for the time.
Moderate Republican, a supporter of William H. Seward in 1860, not Lincoln, but quickly converted, you know, after some bruising early days to becoming a Lincoln man. But in 1864, here is Henry Raymond's life. He has four things he's doing. One, he's editor of the very powerful New York Times. B, he's chairman of the Republican National Committee in a presidential election year. C, he's running for Congress from Manhattan.
I don't think this would happen today.
I don't think so. And finally, he's the author of a 700-page, that's even longer than my book, campaign biography of Abraham Lincoln. And campaign biographies were really important. They were the equivalent of the TV commercials that air now for candidates. So if that's not an example of cross-pollination between the press and the politics, I don't know what is.
And there were about 4,000 newspapers in America at the time, but you focus on the big three. In addition to Raymond at the New York Times, who were the other big guns of American journalism?
And I did focus on the New York big three, not only because, as a New Yorker, I'm interested, but the justification is that they had tremendously influential national editions. They got the European news first, they got the New York State news first, the national news first, and then all of their news went west and south. People used to say, all the newspapers come from New York, they don't go to New York. So the first of them is James Gordon Bennett. He was a Scottish-born founder of the Penny Press, which is equivalent to the tabloids of today, a Democrat who had expected to be supported by the Andrew Jackson administration, and when he didn't, when Jackson and then Van Buren shunned him, he became more independent than the other two.
Mm-hmm.
He hated all political parties, but he was reliably Democratic, racist, anti-Semitic, sensationalistic. He had the equivalent of a tabloid newspaper called the New York Sun, and it was wildly popular. He spent a fortune to make it the most timely newspaper there was, sent, you know, hundreds of reporters into the field during the Civil War. But he was a bit wild and, you know, engaged in duels and fist fights and canings with other publishers on the street, hated by most other editors and sort of a social pariah. And then the second was Horace Greeley. Horace Greeley was the founder of the New York Tribune, which was the most liberal of the Republican papers in New York City, anti-slavery, pro-emancipation, but very mercurial, very unpredictable where Lincoln was concerned. He knew Lincoln when they both served in Congress. Greeley, too, was an aspiring politician. But they never quite meshed. They were both unusual characters, unusual looking. They had both been born in log cabins. They both loved to read. They should have been friends, but it was just oil and water. They never hit it off. And Greeley was quite often disloyal to Lincoln during his presidency, which was a very rare thing in a world in which journalists were strictly towing the party line. And then the third, of course, is Henry Raymond, who breaks away from Greeley. He worked for Greeley as managing editor. Broke away from him because he was too cheap and too prone to faddish causes that Raymond didn't think were really important to the Whig and later the Republican cause. And those three were the titans. They competed for circulation. They built huge businesses. They were famous all around the country, not only through the national editions, but because whatever was printed in the Times was reprinted in Dubuque and Des Moines.
What was Lincoln's general attitude toward the press?
You know, he considered himself something of a journalist, as many politicians did. In his early days, he wrote anonymous editorials, lambasting Democrats. Even as president-elect, when he wanted his policies broadly circulated, it wouldn't do for a president-elect to hold a news conference in those days or even make a statement. He wrote editorials that he knew would be reliably published without editing or emendation in the Springfield Republican paper and then be reprinted. He instructed Henry Raymond when he was president-elect on how to answer thorny political questions about his so-called radicalism. And then as president, he sort of developed a network of journalists, you know, all editors, to whom he leaked information when he wanted, and to whom he sent what we call public letters when he wanted to reach the broadest number of people. Again, you don't do it by having a news conference in the 1860s. You write a statement that appears in newspapers around the country, sort of a direct appeal to the people, akin to, you know, a fireside chat or an Oval Office speech. And Lincoln mastered that. So he was a wire puller who knew the press well. He knew journalists. And by the way, secured their loyalty once he was elected by doling out a huge number of federal jobs to journalists. Remember, Lincoln was the first Republican president, so he got to overhaul the federal bureaucracy and appoint postmasters, ambassadors, well, they called them ministers then, consuls. Hundreds of journalists were rewarded, and people like Raymond and Greeley got to name people who they wanted to get federal jobs.
Right.
So Someone joked that the New York Tribune would not be able to operate beginning in 1861 because so much of the newsroom had gone off to Europe in consul positions.
So that's the friendly press patronage side. Who were his enemies in the press? Did he have a big nemesis? Was it James Gordon Bennett?
Well, Bennett was a nemesis, certainly, because he was a critic, but Bennett was very pro-Union, particularly after Fort Sumter, when he didn't fly an American flag quickly enough and a mob gathered outside his headquarters down in downtown Manhattan. He quickly converted and became very pro-Union and, of course, flew a flag. He never supported Lincoln openly, but Lincoln continued to court him and sent him letters from time to time thanking him for his expressions of support for the Union cause, if not for emancipation. But he definitely had nemesis. In his day in Springfield, there was a Democratic paper called The Register that attacked him unceasingly, beginning with the earliest days of his political career in the 1830s. In Chicago, the Chicago Times became a severe critic during the period of the Lincoln-Douglas debates in 1858. And that paper was closed down by the military in 1863 for criticizing the draft. Lincoln countermanded the order because the people in Chicago sort of erupted. But Chicago Times, when it resumed publication, continued its attacks on Lincoln, as any Democratic paper would. In New York, the New York World, which was sort of middle-of-the-road, leaning Republican, got into some financial hot water in the middle of the Civil War and got sold to a Democratic boss and became an ardently anti-Lincoln paper. In 1864, they published a proclamation by the president that turned out to be bogus, and that was the only instance in which Lincoln signed an executive order closing down a newspaper and arresting the editor. So, I mean, just imagine it today. Abraham Lincoln ordered the arrest of the editor of a New York newspaper, not even for criticizing him in this instance, but for leaking something. It's pretty extraordinary.
And what was this that they leaked?
They received a proclamation from a runner who came from the wires early one night, and it said the president was calling for 500,000 new conscripts or draftees because General Grant was so bogged down in Virginia in 1864. It was a presidential election year.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln and his cabinet went sort of out on half-cocked on this because they were, in fact, drafting such a proclamation. And it turned out that it was sort of a plot hatched by a reporter from Brooklyn, from the Brooklyn Eagle, who thought if he put out a bogus proclamation, the stock market would go down, he would buy some stocks, and then when it was revealed that it was a forgery, the market would rebound and he would make a killing. So it wasn't political.
It wasn't even political.
But Lincoln feared that there was a tremendous leak in the White House and the cabinet and that the editor of the New York World was complicit in it and it was going to hurt conscription and manpower in the army, and overreacted. Almost sent the editor... Well, the general who arrested him almost sent him to what was called the American Bastille, Fort Lafayette, off the Brooklyn coast. But cooler heads prevailed, and after a couple of days, the New York World resumed publication. But, you know, the newspapers were shut down in 1861 as well. New York was a particular place where newspapers that argued against recruitment, against joining the Union Army, were denied access to the post office. Copies were thrown off railroad trains. Editors were arrested. It was pretty brutal.
How did Lincoln deal with a hostile press personally? Did he take it personally? Did it get to him?
We only know of one instance in which it drove him completely crazy, and that occurred. Again, it was the New York World. But during the 1864 reelection campaign, the World repeatedly, I mean day after day, repeated a false story that when Lincoln had visited the battlefield at Antietam 2 years earlier, he had asked his aide to sing a comic song as he walked among the dead and wounded who were still littering the battlefield. And Lincoln took that so personally. You know, he ignored it for a while, but he actually ghost wrote a letter that would go to the New York World from that would be sent over the signature of the aide, saying that he had never seen a grave that had not been rained upon. I love that. I mean, nobody would have thought it was the aide who wrote like that. They would have known it was Lincoln, and never a wounded person, and that any song that he asked to sing occurred later when he needed cheering up. But in the end, he said, if my character is not known well enough that people don't believe it, then it doesn't matter. So he decided not to send the letter. But he was very hurt by that story, and that's one instance in which it got under his skin. Otherwise, he just fought back. He didn't like leaks. He got very angry at editors who leaked things. He hated when his words were garbled, which happened occasionally. And he would write sort of angry letters saying he doesn't understand how this could happen when he sent a clean text. So he was on it. He was on the case.
So in certain respects, nothing has changed with the relationship between politicians and the press. Harold, thank you so much for joining us.
Pamela, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The book, again, is Lincoln and the Power of the Press, The War for Public Opinion by Harold Holzer.
This is Paul Sagal, an editor at the Book Review. We're joined now by Greg Coles with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Paul.
So what's going on?
Well, you may have heard there's a new novel by George R. R. Martin. Or you may not have heard because it's a children's book.
Oh, really?
We have it at new at number 5 on the young adult list this week, although I think it may really be a middle grade novel. The name of the book is The Ice Dragon, and it's for ages 9 to 12, which typically would put it on our middle grade list.
Yeah, with age-appropriate gore, I would expect.
Yeah, maybe not for fans of Game of Thrones, although surely that's who's buying it.
Yeah.
There are a few other new kids' books this week. There's a new series by Maggie Stiefvater named The Raven Cycle that is new at number 10 on the series list. And a couple of picture books. Jan Brett has a new one called The Animal's Santa at number 8. Judy Schachner has the next entry in her Skippy John Jones picture book series called Snow What, new at number 3. Then over on the adult side of things, a few new titles on the fiction list. Craig Johnson has a story collection called Wait for Signs. Craig Johnson writes this Wyoming mystery series about Sheriff Walt Longmire. There's been kind of a trend lately on the fiction list of mystery writers, people with series of mystery novels, who turn to story collections and get bestsellers that way. Sue Grafton did it. Last year she had a collection called Kinsey and Me, and it was short stories.
So they're leading their fans into other genres.
Exactly. C.J. Box, another Wyoming mystery writer, who does the Joe Pickett mystery series, had a story collection earlier this year called Shots Fired, and that was also on the list. So novelists kind of turning to bite-size things. The next new title on the fiction list this week is part of Sophie Kinsella's Shopaholic series. It's called Shopaholic to the Stars, new at number 11. Wilbur Smith, the South African novelist, has a historical novel called Desert God. He does a lot of historical novels set in Africa, but this one goes all the way back to ancient Egypt, so a little further back than the stuff that he got famous for. That's new at number 6. At number 5, Chuck Palahniuk, author of Fight Club and sundry other cult hits, has a new novel called Beautiful You, a novel in which the villain at the center of it is trying to take over the world by selling vibrators to ladies.
Just to ladies, then.
Yeah, well, yeah, anyone who wants to buy them, I guess. And then at number 1, John Grisham has a new novel called Gray Mountain. The heroine of that one is a big city lawyer who goes to a small town in coal country to volunteer at a clinic down there for a year and starts to uncover corruption in the coal industry.
Because lots of familiar names on the list. What about nonfiction?
Some familiar names also on the nonfiction list, although they're not all familiar as authors. At number 15, Chris Hadfield, the Canadian astronaut, not to be confused with James Hetfield of Metallica. Although Hadfield did become famous for a YouTube clip singing Space Oddity, David Bowie's song, from orbit. He's now a multimedia sensation. He's not just a singer. He's also a photographer. He has a book called You Are Here, a book of photos that he took from the International Space Station. And that's new on the list at number 15. Then at number 10, the human rights lawyer and certified MacArthur genius, Brian Stevenson, has a memoir called Just Mercy. He is the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, which both works to overturn convictions of people who were wrongly convicted and also to reduce sentences. He's very focused on racial disparities in sentencing and in drug crimes and the mentally ill. He's concerned with poverty and justice. He's basically looking for fairer sentencing even for the guilty and then in establishing innocence for people who've been wrongly
convicted. And this is a memoir?
It is a memoir. It goes back and looks at his life. It talks about some of the biggest cases that he has worked on. It also is partly just making the case that the justice system is stacked against the poor, stacked against minorities, stacked against the mentally ill.
Even against children, I think, too. He looks at sort of like the way that black youths are sentenced.
That's right. He talks about the move lately to try juveniles as adults and how damaging that is and how we're willing to forgive juveniles a lot of things. We don't want them to smoke. We don't want them to drink, all of this, because we understand that their minds aren't fully formed yet. And yet when they commit a crime.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I hear great things about the way that it's written, too. I think Ted Conover reviewed it for us, and he really compared it in certain ways to To Kill a Mockingbird, just like the sort of moral force of the story.
There is the central case that he talks about in the book is a guy who was convicted of murder and sentenced to death in Monroeville, Alabama, which is actually where, of course, Harper Lee lives and where To Kill a Mockingbird takes place. This guy, an African-American guy, a lot of prosecutorial misconduct in that case. He was like 16 miles away from the crime scene. A bunch of people placed him there, including a police officer, said, oh, yeah, he was over there. You know, he had nothing to do with it. The two eyewitnesses who testified against him were both extremely compromised. The prosecution knew there was all of this exculpatory evidence, and they never handed it over to the defense. So Brian Stevenson says here in Monroeville, Alabama, they're very proud of To Kill a Mockingbird. They love the story. They love celebrating the story. And yet they have a real life case in their hands. And they say, oh, let him hang. Let him die. The judge in that case was named Robert E. Lee Key. So it's a hard story to beat. Then at number three, the last new title on this week's nonfiction list is by the comedian Jim Gaffigan.
Okay, something a little lighter.
Last year he had a big hit with a book called Dad is Fat. It spent 15 weeks on the hardcover list. His follow-up to that is called Food,
Hard-hitting.
A Love Story.
Okay.
That's new at number three.
Okay, thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Parl.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.